Prax released the seal on his helmet, lifted it off, and took a deep breath of the ship's air. He switched to an outside camera. The monster was drifting behind the ship, suddenly visible again in the faint light coming out of the cargo bay, and slowly receding from view. It was wrapped around his radioactive bait. "A bomb," Holden said. "You're telling me that thing left a bomb?" "And pretty damn peculiar, too, if you ask me," Amos replied. "Amos, come with me into the cargo airlock," Holden said. "Alex, what's left to do before we burn that monster up? Is Prax back inside?"
"You guys in the lock?"
Alex said.
"We are now. Do it."
"Don't need to say it twice," Alex said. "Brace for acceleration."
The biochemical cascade that came from euphoria and panic and the reassurance of safety slowed Prax's response time so that when the burn began, he didn't quite have his legs under him. He stumbled against the wall, knocking his head against the inner door of the airlock. He didn't care. He felt wonderful. He'd gotten the monster off the ship. It was burning up in the Rocinante's fiery tail, even as he watched. Then, an angry god kicked the side of the ship and sent it spinning across the void. Prax was ripped from his feet, the gentle magnetic tug of his boots not enough to stop it. The outer airlock door rushed at him, and the world went black. Chapter 28 Avasarala. There was another spike, a third one. Only this time, there didn't seem to be any chance of Bobby's monsters being involved. So maybe, it was coincidence. Which opened the question. If the thing hadn't come from Venus, then where? The world, however, had conspired to distract her. "She's not what we thought she was, ma'am," Sarin said. "I fell for the little lost Martian thing, too. She's good." Avasarala leaned back in her chair. The intelligence report on her screen showed the woman she'd called Roberta Draper in civilian clothes. If anything, they made her look bigger. The name listed was Amanda Telele, free operative of the Martian Intelligence Service. "I'm still looking into it," Sarin said. "It looks like there really was a Roberta Draper, but she died on Ganymede with the other Marines." Avasarala waved the words away and scrolled through the report. Records of back-channel steganographic messages between the alleged Bobby and the known Martian operative on Luna, beginning the day that Avasarala had recruited her. Avasarala waited for the fear to squeeze her chest. The sense of betrayal. They didn't come. She kept turning to new parts of the report, taking in new information and waiting for her body to react. It kept not happening. "We looked into this, why?" she asked.
"It was a hunch," Sarin said. "It was just the way she carried herself when she wasn't around you. She was a little too slick, I guess. She just didn't seem right. So I took the initiative. I said it was from you. So that I wouldn't look like such a fucking idiot for inviting a mole into my office?"
"Seemed like the polite thing to do," Sarin said.
"If you're looking for ways to reward my good service, I do accept bonuses and promotion."
"I fucking bet you do," Avasarala said.
He waited, leaning a little forward on his toes, waiting for her to give the order to have Bobby arrested and submitted for a full intelligence debriefing. As euphemisms went, full intelligence debriefing was among the most obscene. But they were at war with Mars, and a high-value intelligence agent planted in the heart of the UN would know things that were invaluable. "So," Avasarala thought, "why am I not reacting to this?" She reached out to the screen, paused, pulled back her hand, frowning. "Ma'am?" Soren said. It was the smallest thing, and the least expected. Soren bit at the inside of his bottom lip. It was a tiny movement, almost invisible, like a tell at a poker table. And as she saw it, Avasarala knew. There was no thinking it out, no reasoning, no struggle or second-guessing. It was all simply there, clear in her mind as if she had always known it, complete and perfect. Soren was nervous because the report she was looking at wouldn't hold up to rigorous scrutiny. It wouldn't hold up because it was a fake. It was a fake because Soren was working for someone else, someone who wanted to control the information getting to Avasarala's desk. Nguyen had recreated his little fleet without her knowing it, because Soren was the one watching the data traffic. Someone had known that she would need controlling, handling. This was something that had been prepared for since well before Ganymede had gone pear-shaped. The monster on Ganymede had been anticipated. And so it was, Ehrenreich. He had let her demand her peace negotiations, let her think she'd undermined Nguyen, let her take Bobby onto her staff. All of it so that she wouldn't get suspicious. This wasn't a shard of Venus that had escaped. It was a military project. A weapon that Earth wanted in order to break its rivals before the alien project on Venus finished whatever it was doing. Someone, probably Mao Kukowski, had retained a sample of the protomolecule in some separate and firewalled lab, weaponized it, and opened bidding. The attack on Ganymede had been, on one hand, a proof of concept assault, on the other, a crippling blow to the outer planet's food supply. The OPA had never been on the list of bidders. And then Nguyen had gone to the Jovian system to collect the goods. James Holden and his pet botanist had walked in on some part of it, and Mars had figured out that they were about to lose the trade. Avasarala wondered how much Ehrenreich had given Jules-Pierre Mao to outbid Mars. It would have had to be more than just money. Earth was about to get its first protomolecule weapon, and Ehrenreich had kept her out of the loop because whatever he was going to do with it, she wasn't going to like it. And she was one of the only people in the solar system who might have been able to stop him. She wondered whether she still was.
"Thank you, Soren," she said. "I appreciate this. Do we know where she is?"
"She's looking for you," Soren said, and a sly smile tugged at his lips. "She may be under the impression that you're asleep. It is pretty late."
"Sleep? Yes, I remember that vaguely," Avasarala said. "All right, I'm going to need to talk to Ehrenreich."
"Do you want me to have her arrested?"
"No, I don't."
The disappointment barely showed.
"How should we move forward?" Soren asked. "I'll talk to Ehrenreich," she said. "Can you get me some tea?"
"Yes, ma'am," he said, and practically bowed his way out of the room. Avasarala leaned back in her chair. Her mind felt calm. Her body was centered and still, like she'd ended a particularly long and effective meditation. She pulled up the connection request and waited to see how long Ehrenreich or his assistant would take to respond. As soon as she made the request, it was flagged priority pending. 3 minutes later, Ehrenreich was there. He spoke from his hand terminal, the picture jumping as the car he was in bumped and turned. It was full night wherever he was.
"Christian," he said, "is anything wrong?"
"Nothing in particular," Avasarala said, silently cursing the connection. She wanted to see his face. She wanted to watch him lie to her.
"Sarin's brought me something interesting. Intelligence thinks my Martian liaison's a spy."
"Really?" Ehrenreich said. "That's unfortunate. Are you arresting her?"
"I don't think so," Avasarala said. "I think I'll put my own flag on her traffic.
Better the devil we know, don't you agree? The pause was hardly noticeable.
That's a good idea. Do that.
Thank you, sir.
Since I've got you here, I needed to ask you something. Do you have anything that requires you in the office, or can you work on a ship?
She smiled. Here was the next move, then.
What are you thinking about?
Aaron Wright's car reached a stretch of smoother pavement, and his face came into clearer focus. He was wearing a dark suit with a high-collared shirt and no tie. He looked like a priest.
Ganymede, we need to show that we're taking the situation out there seriously. The Secretary General wants someone senior to go there physically, report back on the humanitarian angle. Since you're the one who's taken point on this, he thought you'd be the right face to put on it. And I thought it would give you the chance to follow up on the initial attack, too.
We're in a shooting war, Avasarala said. I don't think the Navy would want to spare a ship to haul my old bones out there. Besides which, I'm coordinating the investigation into Venus, aren't I? Blank check and all.
Aaron Wright grinned exactly as if he'd meant it.
I've got you taken care of.
Jules-Pierre Mao is taking a yacht from Luna to Ganymede to oversee his company's humanitarian aid efforts. He's offered a berth. It's better accommodations than you get at the office. Probably better bandwidth, too. You can monitor Venus from there.
Mao Quick is part of the government now.
I hadn't known, she said.
We're all on the same side. Mao Quick is as interested as anyone in seeing those people cared for.
Avasarala's door opened, and Roberta Draper loomed into the office. She looked like crap. Her skin had the ashy look of that of someone who hadn't slept in too long. Her jaw was set. Avasarala nodded toward the chair.
I take up a lot of bandwidth, she said. Won't be a problem. You'll get first priority on all communications channels.
The Martian sat down across the desk, well out of the camera's cone. Bobby braced her hands on her thighs, elbows to the sides, like a wrestler getting ready to step into the cage. Avasarala made herself not glance at the woman.
Can I think about it?
Christian, Aaron Wright said, bringing his hand terminal closer in, his wide, round face filling the screen.
I've told the Secretary General that this might not fly. Even in the best yacht, traveling out to the Jovian system is a hard journey. If you've got too much to do, or if you're at all uncomfortable with the trip, you just say so and I'll find someone else. They just won't be as good as you.
Who is? Avasarala said with a toss of her hand. Rage was boiling in her gut.
Fine. You've talked me into it. When do I leave?
The yacht's scheduled for departure in 4 days.
I'm sorry for the tight turnaround, but I didn't have confirmation until about an hour ago.
Serendipity.
If I were a religious man, I'd say it meant something. I'll have the details sent to Sorin.
Better send it to me directly, Avasarala said. Sorin's going to have a lot on his plate already.
Whatever you like, he said.
Her boss had secretly started a war. He was working with the same corporations that had let the genie out of the bottle on Phoebe, sacrificed Eros, and threatened everything human. He was a frightened little boy in a good suit, picking a fight he thought he could win because he was pissing himself over the real threat. She smiled at him. Good men and women had already died because of him and Nguyen. Children had died on Ganymede. Belters would be scrambling for calories. Some would starve.
Aaron Wright's round cheeks fell a millimeter. His brows knotted just a bit. He knew that she knew. Because of course he did. Players at their level didn't deceive each other. They won even though their opponents knew exactly what was happening. Just like he was winning against her right now.
Are you feeling all right? He asked. I think this is the first conversation we've had in 10 years where you haven't said something vulgar.
Avasarala grinned at the screen, reaching out her fingertips as if she could caress him.
Cunt, she said carefully.
When the connection dropped, she put her head in her hands for a moment, blowing out her breath and sucking it back in hard, focusing. When she sat up, Bobby was watching her.
"Evening," Avasarala said.
"I've been trying to find you," Bobby said. "My connections were blocked." Avasarala grunted.
"We need to talk about something. Someone. I mean Sarin," Bobby said. "You remember that data you wanted him to take care of a couple days ago? He handed it off to someone else. I don't know who, but they were military, I'll swear to that."
So that's what spooked him, Avasarala thought.
Caught with his hands in the cookie jar. Poor idiot had underestimated her pet marine.
"All right," she said.
"I understand that you don't have any reason to trust me," Bobby said. "But, okay, why are you laughing?"
Avasarala stood up, stretching until her joints and her shoulders ached pleasantly.
"At this moment, you are literally the only one on my staff who I can trust as far as I can piss. You remember when I said that the thing on Ganymede wasn't us? It wasn't then, but it is now. We've bought it, and I assume we're planning to use it against you."
Bobby stood up. Her face, once just ashen, was bloodless.
"I have to tell my superiors," she said, her voice thick and strangled.
"No, you don't. They know. And you can't prove it yet any more than I can. Tell them now and they'll broadcast it, and we'll deny it and blah, blah, blah. The bigger problem is that you're coming back to Ganymede with me. I'm being sent."
She explained everything. Sorin's false intelligence report, what it implied, Ehrenreich's betrayal, and the mission to Ganymede on the Mao Quick yacht.
"You can't do that," Bobby said.
"It's a pain in the ass," Avasarala agreed. "They'll be monitoring my connections, but they're probably doing the same here. And if they're shipping me to Ganymede, you can be dead sure that nothing is going to happen there. They're putting me in a box until it's too late to change anything. Or that's what they're trying, anyway. I'm not giving away the fucking game yet."
"You can't get on that ship," Bobby said. "It's a trap."
"Of course it's a trap," Avasarala said, waving a hand. "But it's a trap I have to step into. Refuse a request from the Secretary General? That comes out and everyone starts thinking I'm about to retire. No one backs a player who's going to be powerless next year. We play for the long term, and that means looking strong for the duration. Ehrenreich knows that. It's why he's played it this way."
Outside, another shuttle was lifting off. Avasarala could already hear the roar of the burn, feel the press of thrust and false gravity pushing her back. It had been 30 years since she'd been out of the Earth's gravity well. This wasn't going to be pleasant.
"If you get on that ship, they'll kill you," Bobby said, making each word its own sentence.
"That's not how this game gets played," Avasarala said.
"What they?"
The door opened again. Sorin had a tray in his hands. The teapot on it was cast iron with a single handleless enamel cup. He opened his mouth to speak, then saw Bobby. It was easy to forget how much larger she was until a man Sorin's height visibly cowered before her.
"My tea, that's excellent. Do you want any, Bobby?"
"No."
"All right. Well, put it down, Sorin. I'm not drinking it with you standing there." "Good. And pour me a cup."
Avasarala watched him turn his back on the marine. His hands didn't shake. She'd give the boy that much. Avasarala stood silent, waiting for him to bring it to her as if he were a puppy learning to retrieve a toy. When he did, she blew across the surface of the tea, scattering the thin veil of steam. He carefully didn't turn to look at Bobby.
"Will there be anything else, ma'am?"
Avasarala smiled. How many people had this boy killed just by lying to her? She would never know for certain, and neither would he. The best she could do was not another.
"Sorin," she said, "they're going to know it was you."
It was too much. He looked over his shoulder. Then he looked back, greenish with anxiety.
"What do you mean?" he said, trying for charm. "Them. If you're counting on them to help your career, I just want you to understand that they won't. The kind of men you're working for? Once they know you've slipped, you're nothing to them. They have no tolerance for failure. Neither do I. Don't leave anything personal at your desk."
She watched it in his eyes. The future he'd planned and worked for, defined himself by, fell away. A life on basic support rose in its place. It wasn't enough. It wasn't nearly enough. But it was all the justice she could manage on short notice. When the door was closed, Bobby cleared her throat. "What's going to happen to him?" she asked. Avasarala sipped her tea. It was good, fresh, green tea, brewed perfectly. Rich and sweet and not even slightly bitter.
"Who gives a shit?" she said.
"The Mao Quick yacht leaves in 4 days. That's not much time. And neither of us is going to be able to take a dump without the bad guys knowing. I'm going to get you a list of people I need to have drinks or lunch or coffee with before we leave. Your job is to arrange it so I do."
"I'm your social secretary now?" Bobby said, bristling.
"You and my husband are the only two people alive who I know aren't trying to stop me," Avasarala said. "That's how far down I am right now. This has to happen, and there is no one else I can rely on. So yes, you are my social secretary. You're my bodyguard, you're my psychiatrist, all of it. You."
Bobby lowered her head, breathing out through flared nostrils. Her lips pursed, and she shook her massive head once quickly, left, then right, then back to center.
"You're fucked," she said. Avasarala took another sip of her tea. She should have been ruined. She should have been in tears. She'd been cut off from her own power, tricked. Jules Pierre Mao had sat there, not a meter from where she was now, laughing down his sleeve at her. Aaron Wright and Nguyen and whoever else was in his little cabal, they'd tricked her. She'd sat there, pulling strings and trading favors and thinking that she was doing something real. For months, maybe years, she hadn't noticed that she was being closed out. They'd made a fool of her. She should have been humiliated. Instead, she felt alive. This was her game. And if she was behind at halftime, it only meant they expected her to lose. There was nothing better than being underestimated.
"Do you have a gun?"
Bobby almost laughed. "They don't like having Martian soldiers walking around the United Nations with guns. I have to eat lunch with a dull spork. We're at war."
"All right, fine. When we get on the yacht, you're in charge of security. You're going to need a gun. I'll arrange that for you."
"You can? Honestly, though, I'd rather have my suit."
"Your suit? What suit?"
"I had custom-fit powered armor with me when I came here. The video feed of the monster was copied from it. They said they were turning it over to your guys to confirm the original footage hadn't been faked."
Avasarala looked at Bobby and sipped her tea. Michael John would know where it was. She'd call him the next morning. Arranged to have it brought on board the Mao Quick yacht with an innocuous label like wardrobe stamped on the side. Probably thinking she needed to be convinced, Bobby kept talking.
"Seriously, get me a gun, I'm a soldier. Get that suit for me, I'm a superhero. If we've still got it, you'll have it."
"All right then," Bobby said. She smiled. For the first time since they'd met, Avasarala was afraid of her.
"God help whoever makes you put it on," she thought.
Chapter 29. Holden. Gravity returned as Alex brought the engine up, and Holden floated down to the deck of the cargo bay airlock at a gentle half-G. They didn't need to go fast, now that the monster was outside the ship. They just needed to put some distance between the ship and it, and get it into the drive's star-hot exhaust plume, where it would be broken down into its various subatomic particles. Even the protomolecule couldn't survive being reduced to ions. He hoped, anyway. When he touched down on the deck, he intended to turn on the wall monitor and check the aft cameras. He wanted to watch the thing being torched. But the moment his weight came down, a white, hot spike of pain took his knee. He yelped and collapsed. Amos drifted down next to him, then kicked off his boot mags and started to kneel. "You okay, Cap?" he said. "Fine. I mean, for I think I blew out my knee levels of fine." "Yeah, joint injury's a lot less painful in microgravity, ain't it?" Holden was about to reply when a massive hammer hit the side of the ship. The hull rang like a gong. The Rossi's engine cut off almost instantly, and the ship snapped into a flat spin. Amos was lifted away from Holden and thrown across the airlock to slam against the outer door. Holden slid along the deck to land standing upright against the bulkhead next to him, his knee collapsing under him so painfully he nearly blacked out. He chinned a button in his helmet, and his body armor shot him full of amphetamines and painkillers. Within seconds, his knee still hurt, but the pain was very far away and easy to ignore. The threatening tunnel vision vanished, and the airlock became very bright. His heart started to race. "Alex," he said, knowing the answer before he asked. "What was that?"
"When we torched our passenger there, the bomb in the cargo bay went off," the pilot replied. "We've got serious damage to that bay, to the outer hull, and to engineering. Reactor went into emergency shutdown. The cargo bay turned into a second drive during the blast and put us into a spin. I have no control over the ship."
Amos groaned and began moving his limbs.
"That sucks."
"We need to kill this spin," Holden said. "What do you need to get the attitude thrusters back up?" "Holden," Naomi cut in, "I think Prax may be injured in the airlock. He's not moving in there."
"Is he dying?"
The hesitation lasted for one very long second. "His suit doesn't think so."
"Then ship first," Holden said. "First aid after. Alex, we've got radios again, and the lights are on, so the jamming is gone, and the batteries must still be working. Why can't you fire the thrusters?"
"Looks like primary and secondary pumps are out. No water pressure."
"Confirmed," Naomi said a second later. "Primary wasn't in the blast area. If it's toast, engineering must be a mess. Secondary's on the deck above. It shouldn't have been physically damaged, but there was a big power spike just before the reactor went offline. Might have fried it or blown a breaker."
"Okay, we're on it. Amos?" Holden said, pulling himself over to where the mechanic lay on the cargo airlock's outer door. "You with me?"
Amos gave a one-handed belter nod, then groaned.
"Just knocked the wind out of me is all."
"Gotta get up, big man," Holden said, pushing himself to his feet. In the partial gravity of their spin, his leg felt heavy, hot, and stiff as a board. Without the drugs pouring through him, standing on it would have probably made him scream. Instead, he pulled Amos up, putting even more pressure on it. "I will pay for this later," he thought. But the amphetamines made later seem very far away.
"What?"
Amos said, slurring the word. He probably had a concussion, but Holden would get him some medical attention later when the ship was back under their control.
"We need to get to the secondary water pump," Holden said, forcing himself to speak slowly in spite of the drugs.
"What's the fastest access point?"
"Machine shop," Amos replied, then closed his eyes and seemed to fall asleep on his feet.
"Naomi," Holden said, "can you control Amos's suit from there?"
"Yes.
Shoot him full of speed.
I can't drag his ass around with me, and I need him.
Okay, she said. A couple of seconds later, Amos's eyes popped open.
Shit, he said. Was I asleep?
His words were still slurred, but now had a sort of manic energy to them. We need to get to the bulkhead access point in the machine shop. Grab whatever you think we'll need to get the pump running. It might have blown a breaker or fried some wiring. I'll meet you there.
Okay, Amos said,
then pulled himself along the tow ring set into the floor to get to the inner airlock door. A moment later, it was open, and he crawled out of view. With the ship spinning, gravity was pulling Holden to a point halfway between the deck and the starboard bulkhead. None of the ladders and rings set into the ship, for use in low G or under thrust, would be oriented in the right direction. Not really a problem with four working limbs, but it would make maneuvering with one useless leg difficult. And, of course, once he moved past wherever the ship's center of spin was, everything would reverse. For a moment, his perspective shifted. The vicious Coriolis rattled the fine bones inside his ears, and he was riding a spinning hunk of metal lost in permanent freefall. Then he was under it, about to be crushed. He flushed with the sweat that came a moment before nausea as his brain ran through scenarios to explain the sensations of the spin. He chinned the suit controls, pumping a massive dose of emergency anti-nausea drugs into his bloodstream. Without giving himself more time to think about it, Holden grabbed the tow rings and pulled himself up to the inner airlock door. He could see Amos filling a plastic bucket with tools and supplies he was yanking out of drawers and lockers.
Naomi, Holden said, going to take a peek in engineering. Do we have any cameras left in there?
She made a sort of disgusted grunt he interpreted as a negative, then said, I've got systems shorted out all over the ship. Either they're destroyed or the power is out on that circuit. Holden pulled himself over to the deck-mounted pressure hatch that separated the machine shop from engineering. A status light on the hatch blinked an angry red.
Shit. I was afraid of that.
What? Naomi asked.
You don't have environmental readings either, do you?
Not from engineering. That's all down.
Well, Holden said with a long sigh, the hatch thinks there's no atmosphere on the other side. That incendiary charge actually blew a hole through the bulkhead and engineering is in vacuum.
Uh-oh, Alex said. Cargo bay's in vacuum too.
And the cargo bay door is broken, Naomi added. And the cargo airlock.
And a partridge in a fucking pear tree, Amos said with a disgusted snort. Let's get the damn ship to stop spinning and I'll go outside and take a look at it.
Amos is right, Holden said, giving up on the hatch and pushing himself to his feet.
He staggered down a steeply angled bulkhead to the access panel where Amos was now waiting, bucket in hand.
First things first.
While Amos used a torque wrench to unbolt the access panel, Holden said, Actually, Naomi, pump all the air out of the machine shop, too.
No atmo below deck four. Override the safeties so we can open the engineering hatch if we need to.
Amos ran out the last bolt and pulled the panel off the bulkhead. Beyond it lay a dark, cramped space filled with a confusing tangle of pipes and cabling.
Oh, Holden added. Might want to prep an SOS if we can't get this fixed.